across America. Live, this is Point of View. And now, Kirby Anderson.
First hour today, we're going to spend some time talking about Islam and our battle with and fight against jihadists. And maybe to introduce that, let me take you back to a movie called The Matrix. And if you remember The Matrix, there was a time in which Neo is confronted by whether or not he takes the red pill or the blue pill. If he takes the blue pill, he goes to sleep, forgets everything. If he takes the red pill, he is able to see something that he did not know was there. Our next guest is an individual that used to actually provide what came to be known as the red pill briefings, because it caused those people in the Defense Department, Homeland Security, and elsewhere to understand a little bit more about what was really going on. Our guest is Stephen Coughlin, and he is with the Center for Security Policy. He's an attorney, a decorated intelligence officer, and a specialist on Islamic law and ideology. He oftentimes was cited as Pentagon's leading expert on Islamic law when he was there. Of course, he was kicked out a number of years ago. We'll talk more about that in just a minute. He's spoken at the Naval War College, at the Marine Corps Quantico, for the FBI CENTCOM, and we can go through a very long list. He is the author of this book, Catastrophic Failure, Blindfolding America in the Face of Jihad. And Stephen, thank you for joining us today here on Point of View.
Well, thank you for having me. I have to say that movie, Matrix, if you ever watch it, seems to be a movie that truly foretold of events to come.
Well, and again, they referred to your briefings as red pill briefings, because what happened is people, if they took the red pill, began to see things in our government, things traveling around the world from a different perspective because of your insight into Islamic thought and law. And I know that one of the individuals, I think it was Christine Brim, actually encouraged you to put all this together in a book, which is quite extensive. I've got the digital copy and have looked at every screen related to that. But you might share with our audience why she suggested that you actually put it together in this book.
Well, you know, people will laugh when I say this. It was called the Red Pill Brief by some of the special operations people who would see the brief. And no matter what they thought when they left, because, you know, there'd be some skeptics, about 3 or 4 weeks later, something would happen, and they'd realize something. And they, like the red pill in the movie Matrix, once you take that red pill, it doesn't matter. You're going to come over, and you'll never go back. Now, most of those people are now fired. I say that jokingly. But what happened is this was a very effective brief. You know, my background was I was mobilized onto the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and my background was I'm a lawyer by training, international comparative law, and I work for an international publishing company. And so I had some familiarity with studying non-Western law. And so I'm brought onto the Joint Chiefs of Staff Intelligence Directorate to analyze the enemy. And I realized that this enemy says they wage jihad to follow Islamic law and to impose it. And so my point of view was, first of all, it's a fact that they say this. Second of all, there is something called Islamic law. It is published, and you can know it. And then what I was able to show was, if you understand how they understand it, and you understand how the Muslim Brotherhood created a paradigm so that if you understand Islamic law, you can understand what they're going to do, you can actually forecast what they're going to do. And I was very, very successful. Now, this briefing became so well known that Christine Brim, then still at the Center for Security Policy, said flat out, "Steve, one of these days someone's going to kill you.
Wow.
We won't have these briefings." And she really did say that, and she really was serious. In fact, a couple of people went up to her and said, "You shouldn't have said that." So what happened is, over a series of years, when I first agreed to write the book, things became the stuff I was following escalated so fast that the book would get done and be overcome by events, and then it would get redone and overcome by events. We finally got it done, and so it was current at the time it was released this month, and there it is. But yes, it was a very effective series of briefings that some people were worried that if something happened to me, there would be no record of it.
Well, again, I want to encourage people to find out a little bit more. We have a link to it on our website, so people can click on that and find out more. We also have one of the briefings that you did. I think this was in Austria, but it still gives you an idea of kind of what you covered. And I've got to say, Stephen, that I've been aware of the book, and I'm certainly aware of some of your colleagues. So when I got the book, I expected to have a lot of strategy, which it does later on. But the first part of the book is very much like my book, A Biblical Point of View on Islam. It's just basic Islamic teaching. And I think it underscores a point. That is, there are individuals perhaps in our government who have at best a Wikipedia understanding of Islam. Matter of fact, that's maybe too generous, because I think you'd learn as much reading Wikipedia about Islamic law as some of them seem to know. And so as a result, you had to really kind of go back to basics and just explain some of the basic tenets of Islam in order for those individuals who are fighting jihadists to really understand what they were up against.
You know, you're exactly right. And, you know, sometimes I would scream when I was in the Pentagon one of two lines. You cannot write a PhD thesis on Cliff Notes. You cannot do college level calculus on third grade math. You have to up your game. You can't have a strategy to defeat an enemy you will not define. And you can't create crib notes for that. What we have is a military that once you get to the rank of full bird captain and he gets to be senior, almost everything you get in a briefing is prepared for you. And as you move up to the general officer ranks, what happens is people start to realize what this general likes and what that general likes and what you want to give them, what you don't. And by the time they get to a point where they're in major decision-making modes, every decision they make, and of course I'm speaking broadly here, but not every decision, but a high percentage of decisions they make are based on a quad chart, which is a single sheet of paper broken into four boxes. On the upper right hand, I'll say the problem. The bottom will say what to do. The other will say, you know, options and what decision it is. And, you know, if you are a general who became a second lieutenant during the Cold War, and as a lieutenant, you were in the field in the fold of gap. And then as a company commander, you were learning how to do air-land battle to fight the Soviets. And then as a colonel, you commanded a brigade to fight against GSOG, Group of Soviet Forces Germany. By the time you made it to general in the Cold War, you could make a decision on a five-page sheet of paper because you knew every detail underneath it. But what you have now is a situation where these same generals felt, well, that's not a problem for me because I could just make the same type of decision on a 5x8. And despite the fact that I routinely say, you know, I can't even remember these Arab names. You know, they just clutter things up. I can't really keep straight how they understand this Sharia law stuff. So let's just talk about it being like the Soviet Union. And so what you have are people who know they don't know making decisions based on 5x8 sheets of paper or 10-minute PowerPoint decision briefs in a situation where all they're doing is to them, depth is a stack of 5x8s, five single sheets of decision-making briefs that can answer the question. So I think in a sense, yes, you are right. You know, you have, when I was still on the Joint Staff, General Pace gave a speech at the National Defense University admonishing the officers of the military saying, you need to our great detriment, you have yet to figure out who the enemy is. You had General Myers, who's in the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who wrote a book saying, you know, the situation of the moment always got in the way of coming to have a strategy, and we never had a strategy. And you had General Nagata of SOCOM, Special Operations Command, just recently, late in 2014, saying, you know, we have yet to understand their strategy.
Yes.
Well, you know.
Let me jump in because we have one of those mandatory breaks, but you've got a president that said he doesn't have a strategy. So we have a break. We'll come back. We'll continue our conversation with Stephen Coughlin, and his book is Catastrophic Failure, Blind Folding America in the Face of Jihad. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Point of View, your listener-supported source for truth.
Talking about this new book, Stephen Coughlin is with us. And again, the book is entitled Catastrophic Failure, Blindfolding America in the Face of Jihad. You're going to be hearing a lot more about it, and we're certainly going to do our best in an hour to cover some of that. And Stephen, I thought we might jump in real quickly just to get into some of the Islamic ideas. And you say in the book that really the core of the Red Pill briefings was this evolving analysis of the relationship between the Islamic legal doctrine of abrogation and the Muslim Brotherhood. Let's talk about that for a minute. I'll encourage people to maybe take some notes, but abrogation helps explain why you'll have some Muslims say, well, there are all sorts of verses in the Quran that talk about peace, but of course there are also some that talk about jihad, and those later, quote, revelations abrogate or supersede the others, do they not?
Absolutely. And here's the thing. When you bring this up, you'll get people to get star-eyed on you. And, you know, maybe you're just talking to somebody who is culturally Muslim, like you might meet some people culturally Jewish or Christian, and maybe they don't know. But when you get to the people who end up showing up on TV or you end up going to people who end up showing up at government functions, invariably they either are or are directly aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood. So it becomes immediately important to understand that this doctrine of abrogation, which exists in Islamic law, basically states that those verses revealed later in the period of revelation overrule or control verses that came earlier. Now, this is important because if you look at the Quran, it is not arranged chronologically. So you have to know what the chronological ordering is, at least the relative ordering of it. And there's not universal agreement on that within the Muslim community, but there's enough so that you can get certain fixed points. And one of them is that in the period of Mecca, before Hijra, there was no jihad. Then you have Muhammad going to Medina, and then that's when the Muslim calendar starts, AH, after Hijra. And that's when you first have jihad. Now, the last surah to authoritatively talk about relations with non-Muslims is Surah 5, chapter 5. And the last one to talk about jihad is Surah 9, or chapter 9 of the Quran.
Right.
And, of course, these chapters then control or overrule all the earlier ones. Now, this is important because it is understood as an imam, you are not qualified to become an imam unless you know what are the abrogating and abrogated texts in your school. So this is really quite well established. And yet if you bring this up, they'll say this is not true. Nobody believes it. Only radicals believe it. But you have to get yourself set to know that once you get books that you know are authentic Islamic law, if it says it, that's what it is. Now, what you have is a man named Sayyid Qutb, who was a leader and a strategic thinker in the Muslim Brotherhood
back in
the 50s in Egypt. He actually came to Colorado to get a master's degree in the 50s, believe it or not. But he, while he was waiting to be executed, wrote a book called Milestones. And he basically said, how do we bring Islam back to a world of Islam today in the 60s that is completely backslid into what he called Jahiliya, or total decadence? And he said, well, we must reintroduce Islam today the same way Muhammad brought it in the first generation when it was revealed to him by Allah. So what you see is whether it's the Muslim Brotherhood or Al-Qaeda or Jamaat al-Islamiyah, they all target after this what I call the milestones process of checking where you are today in Islam, if you're the Brotherhood or one of these groups, to where you would have been in the first generation and move forward. So, for example, the name of the book that Sayyid Qutb wrote is The Milestones, because you mark the milestones of where this community is based on where the community was back then. Now, here becomes a little bit of a thing you have to watch out for. You might say in Egypt, the milestones are we can take power, and of course Morsi tried to do that. But in the West, you say, look, Islam has never been here, so we are going to start Islam here in the Medinan period, the Meccan period, where there was no jihad. So we can go in America and say there is no jihad because here it hasn't reached the point of revelation where that becomes operative, and that becomes their message. Why is that important? Because if you are somebody who wants to point out, hey, listen, guys, this is the Brotherhood, and their job is to subvert and to implement Islamic law here, they will tell you are blaspheming their religion, not because you say something's wrong when you say they're building up to after Hijra and jihad. It's because it's considered blasphemy because you said it today, and that hurts them today. And under Islamic concepts of blasphemy and slander, that is true.
So I think it brings us back to something we've talked about before, what you might call a cultural jihad, or this idea of, and I guess we need to take us back to this explanatory memorandum of the Muslim Brotherhood that they were able to discover. Because when some people look at Islam, they say, well, you have the radicals, and that would be, of course, ISIS and Al-Qaeda and all the jihadists. But then they look at others and say, well, Muslim Brotherhood, that's kind of like the Chamber of Commerce for Muslims. But there are really two different kind of strategies, aren't there?
Well, yes. And when we say cultural jihad or stealth jihad, as some people call it, the term in Islamic parlance is dawah. And almost always when we see the word dawah used, and when it's being used to talk to us about it, they'll say Muslim proselytizing. It's actually much more than that. You go find books written by the Muslim Brotherhood in America in English, and a lot of them are about the Dawah mission. And what is that? an Islamic concept of war, the Islamic concept of war, the main effort is not in the jihad or the kinetic battle. The main effort is in the subversion and the desiccation of the previous, the society you want to move into and take over, so that once the jihad hits, you come down like a deck of cards, like the train explosion in Spain around 2002 or 3. So the main effort in civilization jihad is that. Now, you brought up the explanatory memorandum. That is a document that was seized in an FBI raid of a home in 2004, who turned out to be a Muslim Brotherhood leader. His name was Al-Barassi. And they found in his sub-basement the archives, the Muslim Brotherhood archives. And part of that was this document that was written in 1991 by a senior leader of the Brotherhood in America named Muhammad Akram, called the Explanatory Memorandum that outlined the strategic goals of the Muslim Brotherhood in America. How do we know it's the Muslim Brotherhood in America? Because they say, we are the Muslim Brotherhood. And at the end of that document, they list off who their members are and who their allies are. Now, their biggest ally in 1991 was somebody called Islamic Circle of North America, ICNA. Since then, they've joined in with the Brotherhood. Now, what's important about that document is it plainly says that their mission in America is subversion through penetration to get our elite people, our national governmental leaders, our media elites, our religious elites, to subvert their sectors of America for them. And so the phrase they use is a civilization jihadist process where they destroy America from within by our hands. And what you see is almost everywhere you turn, whether it's in the government, the media, or even the religious sphere, you see that it's people who are supposed to be defending, for example, the First Amendment in the media, or defending the Constitution, to support and defend the Constitution, who actually seem to be working with the other side on this. I'm not accusing anybody of treason when I say that. I'm just saying that they're so ideologically confused that they have no comprehension of what they're doing.
Let's, if we can, just before we take a break also, maybe we'll do this after the break because we are coming up to another one of those breaks, talk about what kind of connections we see in the media and in the government and in religion. Because we'll start with the government when we come back from a break, but Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, did she have anybody on staff that was connected to the Muslim Brotherhood? How about anybody that has worked in the White House that's been part of the Muslim Brotherhood? Of course, we can also talk about some of these laws emphasizing Sharia, as well as, of course, the way in which this is covered in the media. But again, we're talking about this concept of civilization jihad, and that's just part of the book, a very significant part, though, I might say, of this book, Catastrophic Failure, Blindfolding America in the Face of Jihad. Stephen Coughlin is with us, and we have some great material about him. First of all, you can click on his picture. We have a bio there. There's a way in which you can order the book. And then we have a video that you can watch, and it's one of many. Once you see the first one, you can even go on and see the rest of all of the so-called red pill briefings. And this is a way to educate yourself about Islam. And so we certainly encourage you to take the time to visit our website, pointofview.net. You'll find some great material there. My commentary today is on the nuclear treaty with Iran. We can talk about that a little bit later if we need to. And of course, we are still encouraging you to do what you can to support those individuals who have been harmed in many cases where their friends, neighbors, or family members have been killed by ISIS. And we have an opportunity to work with a very important organization that actually is engaged in providing some relief and some assistance. So again, the Cradle Fund is a way in which you can support them, and 100% of your donations go to them so that you can buy food or pillows or mattresses or milk, diapers, clothes. All of that's still available on our website, pointofview.net. We'll come back, continue our conversation with Steve Coughlin about his book, Catastrophic Failure. And, of course, we'll also take your phone calls. All that coming up right after this.
We call them ISIS, and we've seen or at least heard about their evil.
We're witnessing a once-in-a-thousand-year crisis in the Middle East. They have a particular lust for Christian blood, and they're not starting something, they're finishing it. City after city in Iraq, there are zero Christians left.
God's call to Abraham, Nineveh. These events happened in what is now Iraq and Syria. It is the cradle of Christianity. What can you do about ISIS? Point of View is partnering with the Cradle Fund to help persecuted Christians. Give now, and we will send 100% of your gift to the Cradle Fund, every penny.
Every act of love on behalf of those ISIS aims to kill is a dagger in the heart of ISIS.
Please, help our persecuted family in the Middle East. Give today online at pointofview.net, pointofview.net, or mail your donation to Point of View, Box 30, Dallas, Texas, 75221. Let us know it's for the Cradle Fund, or call 800-347-5151, 800-347-5151.
Point of View will continue after this.
You are listening to Point of View. The opinions expressed on Point of View do not necessarily reflect the views of the management or staff of this station. And now, here again is Kirby Anderson.
Continue our conversation today with Stephen Coughlin. And again, his book is entitled Catastrophic Failure, Blindfolding America in the Face of Jihad. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-351-1212. It is a book you will learn a lot about, not only Islamic thought and law, but also about some of the very significant threats to us in America. And Stephen, before we get into what's happening in our government, I guess there's at least one other concept we should put on the table. I don't want to overload those, but we've talked about abrogation. One other one, taqiyya. This is the idea of the duty to lie. That's important because a lot of times people say, well, I talk to my Muslim friends and they say, no, there's no problem. We can talk to Islamic leaders and they say, oh, there's no jihad going on. There's no desire for us to turn America into a Muslim country. Are everybody that are saying these things telling the truth?
Well, you know, it depends on who you're talking to. If you're talking to some guy who's a Muslim who just, you know, is running about his life, he may or may not know what he knows or doesn't know. But I think to the point you're asking, to the people who show up for these discussions, the groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, they do know this. As a matter of fact, a book I like to point people to, I have a ton of books on Islamic law, and they're all just as good as this one on one level. But the one I'm talking about right now, Reliance of the Traveler, yes. I like to use as a desktop copy because it was approved by the Muslim Brotherhood in America, specifically the International Institute of Islamic Thought and the Fiqh Council of North America, both known elements of the Muslim Brotherhood. It was also approved by Al-Azhar, which is the most prestigious center of Islamic thought and learning in the world. Its statements have an authoritative air to them. And it was approved by the Saudi Arabians and other countries. And right in there, they don't talk about that you're allowed to lie. They basically say if the only way to further Islam is through lying, you are obligated to lie. And this is important because the language somewhat parallels. Back in 1993, before the U.S. designated Hamas a terrorist organization, but they knew they were terrorists, the FBI bugged a meeting in Philadelphia called these meetings, the tapes were emitted into the Holy Land Foundation trial, where the entity that was speaking there, they eventually changed their name. They folded their organization and created the Council on American Islamic Relations. But at the time, they called themselves Sister Sama, and Sama is Hamas spelled backwards. And what they did was they basically say, listen, you send two messages, one to the Americans and one to our brothers. And so, yes, we have clear information. We have clear awareness that the entities that end up being on TV representing Islam, like CARE or MPAC or ISNA, and we know that the ones that end up helping advise our senior leaders are beholden to a published book of Islamic law that creates the duty to lie, where we've heard them say, and it's been admitted to court, that they said they had a duty to lie. So there's no question about that.
And again, we broadcast all over the nation, but this studio where I'm broadcasting today is not far from where they had a trial with the Holy Land Foundation. So we learned some things in that particular trial, didn't we?
We learned a heck of a lot. We learned who the Brotherhood was. All the defendants were found guilty on 108 separate charges. You know, they were going to go to the second round of trial cases on the Holy Land Foundation, and we had to change administration, and those trials were stood down.
Yes.
But not only were they stood down, but the entire archive of the Muslim Brotherhood we talked about earlier that was seized at Al-Barassi's home by the FBI, they've been sealed. So despite the fact that those records were given to the defense attorneys of the Muslim Brotherhood's entities who were tried, and despite the fact that Judiciary Committee in the House asked for them, nobody can get their hands on them. And why? Because they have such a condemning record of who these people are and what their intentions are and where the money comes to build a lot of these mosques.
Stephen Coughlin with us. We're talking about his book, Catastrophic Failure, Blindfolding America in the Face of Jihad. If you'd like to join us, 1-800-351-1212. Let me come back to my question I asked before the break. Do we have any people that are sympathetic to the Muslim Brotherhood that have worked with, say, the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, or in the White House and the office staff there? What kind of connections do we have right now between the Muslim Brotherhood and our government?
Well, most of the contacts with the government through the Muslim Brotherhood has to do with them coming in at conferences and when they're building up things. Of course, Secretary of State Clinton's chief aide has been Huma Abedin, and she has been linked up with the Brotherhood. I think she was a member of the Muslim Student Association. And I think that Hillary Clinton, when in the Clinton administration, was friends with a man named Abdulrahman Al-Alamoudi, who is now serving, he may be coming up for a release for his part as an al-Qaeda operative and Muslim Brotherhood leader for his part in an attempted assassination of a Saudi member of the Saudi royal family. So we do have that. What happens as often as not, and I chronicle this in the book, one example is Judicial Watch got a Freedom of Information Act on the Department of Homeland Security's Civil Rights, Civil Liberties Division when they were looking to stand up what they call the CVE, the Countering Violent Extremism protocols that they wanted to develop. And in the documents that Judicial Watch got, we find that a high percentage of the people coming in to help DHS do their CVE were known members of the leadership elements of the Muslim Brotherhood,
wow,
including, for example, Muhammad Majid, who is the imam at the Al-Dulles Area Muslim Center and was the head of ISNA, the Islamic Society of North America, understood to be the lead element of the Muslim Brotherhood in America. So what you find is they tend to be brought in to help advise and to help train. So when people like me were pushed out, we actually have the MPAC, Muslim Public Affairs Council, document saying that their goal was to get people like us removed and to get themselves inserted as the trainers of our forces. So that's really, I mean, yes, we have some names like we just mentioned, but the main point of penetration is this influence they bring with them and this idea that they are the Brotherhood, especially this moderate voice of reason. Incidentally, that started with an article that was written, I think, in 2007 in Foreign Affairs by a guy named Lykin. And it was called the Moderate Muslim Brotherhood.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was in the Pentagon, we kind of knew that was the State Department under Secretary Rice announcing the change in policy so that the Moderate Muslim Brotherhood was to be the alternative to the radical al-Qaeda. And I belong to that school of thinking that thinks that the most dangerous element of the war on terror isn't the people we're fighting over there. It's the people who are blinding us here. And so I was one of those people who did not agree with those decisions at all.
I do know that. Just before I take some phone calls, let me take one more issue. I've been talking about things locally. 15 miles from here is where two jihadists attempted to go into a Garland auditorium and kill people because they had cartoons that were in drawings of Muhammad. Part 5 of your book, Days of Rage, you talk about this coordinated effort by various groups, Muslim groups, for the purpose of fomenting days of rage against things like the cartoons of Muhammad or any kind of speech or action that might be considered blasphemous.
This is an extremely important issue for this year, because what you're raising is something that you go to people and ask them, have you ever heard of the OIC? The Organization of Islamic Cooperation, and even inside our government, you'll have most people say, I've never heard of them. The OIC, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, is the second largest intergovernmental organization, second only to the United Nations, and when it forms as a summit, it's attended by all 57 heads of state, actually 56 heads of states and the Palestinians. In 2005, they had a summit where they declared something called the 10-year Program of Action. And this 10-year program of action was to make defamation, as defined by Islamic law, defamation of Islam a crime in every jurisdiction, and they would work through the UN to implement this. In July, the UN, a document that reflects this, and the OIC makes it clear that it is something called UN Resolution 1618. In July 15, 2011, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton flew to Turkey. And in Turkey, she met with the head of the OIC, Ekmeledin İnanoğlu, to agree to have the U.S. State Department use its best efforts to pass Resolution 1618. And then she also committed to them in an official U.S. State Department release that she would use plain old-fashioned techniques of peer pressure and shaming to go after Americans who would dare to exercise their First Amendment rights inside the United States. I think it's utterly spectacular as one of the big dogs that never barks. And the State Department held true, and they hosted the forum where by acclamation, no votes, by acclamation, the UN Human Rights Commission passed 1618. Now the job is to implement it. This is year 10 of that 10-year program of action. And the first thing that happened at the beginning of 2015 were the Charlie Hebdo massacres and the attempted killings at Copenhagen. And then we have these hunter-killer jihadi teams going after Americans, like in Garland, Texas, for doing what? Exercising what they have an absolute protected speech right to
do.
Need
to take a break, but I think you made the point. And when we come back, I'll give some people a chance to ask you some questions. I'm sure you're learning a lot. I did when I read the book, and I would encourage you to do the same. We'll continue our conversation with Stephen Coughlin right after this.
Now, back to Point of View, your listener-supported source for truth.
Stephen Coughlin with us for a few more minutes as we talk about his book, Catastrophic Failure, Blindfolding America in the Face of Jihad. It's a book I know you're going to be hearing a lot more about. Of course, you can find out more about him, the Center for Security Policy, and so many other aspects of what he is doing right now on our website, pointofview.net. I also have a video there that you might want to watch, and it will give you a little bit of an idea of some of those red pill briefings. But let's take some phone calls. We'll head first to Missouri, KCMH. Dave, you're on with Stephen Coughlin.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I'd just like to say that the Islamic Muslim types are getting into locally elected positions, such as judgeships and prosecuting attorneys at the county level. That's what I would like to say. Thank you.
Okay, what about that? You've talked about some of the attempts to sort of change what is happening in America and maybe eventually turn Islam into the dominant religion or certainly turn America into a Muslim country. What about what might be happening at the state at local level?
Well, you know, there's an organization, and it eludes me right now. I'm banging my head right now in the book. I do a brief discussion about how you have an Islamic entity very close to the Brotherhood that seeks to appoint judges or get people from the organization into the legal community at the various court levels, and even to get judges in there, where they basically flat out say, our goal is to make decisions based on Sharia, even if that's not happening. Now, you have to read in the book where I talk about that, and I apologize. It's just on the tip of my mind.
Well, that's okay.
But you, it is there, and there's also an organization just like it for law enforcement. And so I think that the thing to keep in mind is that, you know, you have something called the Islamic Society in North America, and that is the number one Muslim Brotherhood group. There is something called the head of the Muslim Brotherhood is the chief jurist who lives in Qatar. His name is Yusuf al-Kawadari. And he wrote a book that has been translated into English by the Islamic Society in North America called Islamic Societies in Non-Muslim Countries. And it basically talks about what the goal ahead is. And at the local level, you'll find the Islamic Society of Wichita. You'll find the Islamic Society of St. Louis, Missouri. You'll find the Islamic Society in Northern Dallas. You'll find that where a mosque has the name Islamic Society or Islamic Center somewhere in there, there is the overwhelming probability it's a Muslim Brotherhood mosque. And the Holy Land Foundation trial, to the extent that they did get some of that evidence, then showed all the canceled checks. So that an Islamic Society mosque usually was owned by something called the North American Islamic Trust, which held the deed. And at the time, the estimate was that anywhere between 50 to 80% of the mosques were basically controlled by ISNA, owned by NAIT, and funded from Middle Eastern sovereign wealth funds. Now, we've been looking to get stronger statistics, but this basically validates the whole idea that they're working on every level. They work in the international forums. They work at the national level. They work at the local level. These people are hitting on every piston, and they unfortunately know our way of life better than we do, so that we find us Americans are not only defending our religions against their attacks, we're having to defend our own constitution against it, because having decided they wanted to destroy us, they made a point to learn us. And I think that sometimes we have to stop watching too many Dancing with the Stars programs and start saying, if you decide that that's more important than defending your country, it's going to get taken from you. He's absolutely right. They're hitting on every level.
Let's talk about the judges for just a minute, because you talk about the fact that you have the Assembly of Muslim Jurists of America, but that's not really a good translation. If you would actually translate it, it's really called the Association of Legal Specialists in Sharia Law in America. So,
and that's exactly the organization I was thinking of.
Okay.
I couldn't bring to my mind.
Well,
thank you very much.
There you go. But there's a good example of two things. Number one, it's happening. But number two, they use a deceptive translation to hide the fact that their goal is to basically bring Sharia law into every court in America. True?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, that document, we had to have people translate for us, because despite the fact that it was written by an imam in Minneapolis and socialized to a whole bunch of people in the Brotherhood here, it was actually approved in Doha, which makes you think that there might be a Muslim Brotherhood senior level approval of that document. Makes you think that's, I'm being speculative there. And we had to get it translated. And yes, you have that they basically did not translate it completely accurately. But that happens a lot. I can give you a parallel example. Would you like one?
Please do.
Well, if you say, people will say Islam says it's a religion of peace, and then I'll say something to write on it, yeah, right. But actually, Islam is a religion of peace. But Islam defines peace, as total submission.
Submission, yes.
So yeah. When do you have world peace?
When you have a caliphate and a worldwide Sharia law, right?
When the whole world, yeah. Exactly, when the whole world has submitted to Islamic law. So bin Laden is, you know, I was going to make a comment there, when he was alive, could say he's fighting for peace and actually mean it.
Right. Good point. We're just about out of time, and I wanted to mention that, first of all, we have a link to, of course, Center for Security Policy. We have a link to the Counter Jihad Report, which tells a little bit more about the book Catastrophic Failure. We also, of course, have a way in which, if people can't find the book in their bookstore, they certainly can order it online, and we have one of many of your red pill briefs so that people can see a little bit more. So just before I run out of time, talk about what's available on some of those websites, because I'm sure a lot of people, including myself, are saying, I've heard a lot of things today I haven't heard before. I'd like to read a little bit more. Where do I find some information on some of the topics we've been addressing?
Well, I think you can go to the Center for Security Policy. A gentleman named Pat Poole and I formed a 501 ourselves also called Unconstrained Analytics. And it's called, and we just stood up a webpage called unconstrainedanalytics.org. But I think that the webpage you could go to for my book, it's at CSP, Center for Security Policy.
Mm-hmm.
They have a whole lot of information. There's a whole lot going on, whether it's interfaith penetration, whether it's the mass importation of Islamic populations where there's no expectation that they become Americanized. There's all that type of information going on. I think one of the things to point out with the book, and as you read it, it's a big book, and we're talking here casually, but I think it's important to point out that it's as large as it is because it's got the footnotes and the data points to make it clear that this case meets an evidentiary standard, and it also can just support a decision-making if someone wants to move forward on it.
I just might mention that it has 12 parts, two of which are appendices, and 10 parts for the introduction, all the content and conclusion. And again, the book is entitled Catastrophic Failure, Blindfolding America in the Face of Jihad, a monumental work. And I appreciate you giving us some time today here on Point of View.
It was a pleasure.
We appreciate the good work that is done at the Center for Security Policy. Certainly have appreciated Stephen Coughlin. I've followed his career, and I am excited that the book is out. And now your responsibility is to go get a copy and to read it. Pass it on to others. And I also have a video there that you can watch, and maybe you might want to post that on your Facebook page or Twitter page, or encourage other people to learn a little bit more about this, because indeed, we are facing a challenge, and the key to a lot of that is educating ourselves about these issues.